This is the On Humans podcast with your host Ilari Mäkelä. When I started this podcast series, I had a couple of big questions driving me. One was, where do we come from? Just led to many episodes on human evolution and big history. Another was, why do we destroy? A theme that's led into episodes on warfare and will lead into conversations on ecology and climate change. The third was, why do we love? Or more generally, what brings us together? Well, that's the topic of today's conversation. I think it is a fascinating question, the question about human relationships and human bonding. I think bonding is actually a useful term here because it demonstrates in its very meaning that there is something surprising here. Why would anybody want to bind themselves to others, limit their freedom? Why live in bonds if you can live free of them? And yet we all seek for them, and the lack of them is one of the most detrimental things for human health. And we know that biologically. But what happens in the mind? What do we gain besides comfort and support from our friends, from our loved ones, for those with whom we connect? My guest is Arthur Aron. He's one of the world's leading experts on the science of human bonding. And indeed, Aron really studies the whole cycle from the first contact to lifelong relationship satisfaction. He's famous for developing the so-called 36 questions, which are advertised to make you fall in love with anyone, a characterization that he does not agree with exactly, as you will hear. That said, this might not be the worst tool to use if you do want to create intimacy with someone. There are links to them in the show notes. But Aron's work goes well beyond these famous questions. We start by discussing his theory about one of the main drives that pushes us to seek bonds with others. We talk about it especially in the context of romantic bonds, but the theory applies also to friendships, as we will discuss later in the episode. Aron's theory is interesting in itself, but it's also, more importantly, gives a kind of frame by which to understand the two other big themes that we discuss. One is health and happiness in romantic relationships, and the other is friendships and ways to cross ethnic boundaries. On the first of those themes, Aron is actually one of the leading experts, and he gives a lot of practical tips in this conversation. I found a lot of them to be fascinating and deeply practical, something wonderful to share with family and friends at the same time. I know personally that it can be a little bit, I don't know, tragic, sad, frustrating to listen to relationship tips when you're not in one. If you feel the same, not to worry, you're not alone. And we also do turn in the end of the conversation towards more general questions about friendships. We explore Aron's work on group identity and xenophobia, racism. And this is really, for me, the most striking part of Aron's research, the reason I really wanted to have him on the show. I often read that humans can be sociable, even altruistic, but this ends at the boundaries of our groups. We are parochial altruists, as the technical jargon goes, kind to our own, nasty, hostile, mean to the others. But Aron's work suggests that we are not doomed by human nature to stick to our own. His studies have shown time after time that in the right kind of a setting, we all have a deep capacity, even an urge, to reach across borders and bond with those different to ourselves. His work has been applied in areas from university campuses to contact between refugees and native populations in Europe, and with amazingly inspiring results. I hope that you enjoy our conversation. If you do, please consider supporting my work. The easiest thing to do is to subscribe to the show if you haven't done so yet. Give it a nice review. And if you can do so, do support the show financially. I want to thank every one of you who has become a Patreon member or supported me financially in other ways. Without you, I couldn't be continuing the show. If you don't support the show yet, but want to join, you can do so at patreon.com/onhumans. Finally, do have a look at the On Humans newsletter at onhumans.substack.com, where you can read articles, essays, etc., and get nice material straight to your inbox. Anyway, let's get back to the show. I bring to you Arthur Aron. Professor Arthur Aron, welcome to On Humans.
Thank you very much, Ilari.
I guess it's fair to say that humans, by and large, seek for love from romantic partners, but also from family ties, close friendships, and that we don't only want to be loved, but we also want to love. Why?
Well, our theory, self-expansion model, says that one of the basic human motivations, one is to survive, but the other one is to grow, expand, to increase your knowledge and to explore. And when you connect closely with someone else, and that's where you feel love often, when you get close to someone, you include them in the self. They become part of who you are. And that enriches your life, that connection. And in fact, we've shown in lots of research that you mix up who you are with someone you're close to.
Can you give a little bit of an idea of how these studies work?
Well, for example, in one study we've done, we ask people at the beginning to fill out a list of who are you, you know, a bunch of traits, and then also fill this out for another person and for their partner. These are people who have close others. And then later, in another context, we show them each of the traits, and we say, how true is this of you? If that trait is one that's true of themselves and their partner, they're faster to say it's true of me than if it's true of me but not of my partner. Similarly, if it's not true of me and it is true of my partner, I still say it's not true of me, but I'm much slower in giving that response. It's a 20 millisecond response. And people have replicated this many, many times.
And you don't get the effect if it's a non-significant other.
That's right. Yeah. No, if it isn't.
Okay. That's important. Yeah.
Yeah. We've done it. We've had lots of controls and stuff like that. We ask people to rate, to fill out a rating for themselves and a rating for a close other and a rating for someone else. And then we ask them later, okay, there are different traits for the people. And we say, who did you rate this trait for? They mix up. They have trouble remembering whether it's for themselves or the close other. No problem remembering whether it's for the non-close other.
Yeah, yeah. And in a way, I mean, some of that does surprise me. But even to the extent that that we can say, okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, there is this kind of like mixing of identities. You don't just end there. You say that this actually is not just an interesting fact about love, but that it demonstrates something quite profound, which is that one of the things that we seek for in love is that we grow as a person because that other person becomes part of who we become.
Oh, yeah. And what they know and what they, we often mix up what we think we know. You know, actually, one of my closest collaborators I live with, it's my wife. Well, on a lot of our research. You know, we kind of remember who knows what, but it's so easy to mix it up. But I feel I've got not just my knowledge, but her knowledge. I feel I have not only when she has a success, I feel it's my success too. And the intense, passionate love is often when you move from not being in a relationship to being in one where the other is part of the self and that rapid growth. Rapid self-expansion of any kind, even outside a relationship, is very rewarding. But that's what makes love so exciting. Is that rapid growth.
How much do you think those things are cross-culturally valid?
To the extent our research has looked at it, I think it is. You know, a little bit varies with culture is sort of what are the things that make it self-expanding and which relationships want to be self-expanding. But the basic seems to be kind of universal.
On the point of, you said earlier that you think one of the most fundamental human drives is this drive to expand, to seek, to explore. What is the difference between that and love? I mean, I remember you've done research, which is quite interesting, completely leaving love aside for a moment, on things like addiction, right? And how doing novel things like learning a new language or something like that can help people get off of cigarettes, for example.
Yeah.
What then is the difference between, on the one hand, seeking self-expansion by, say, learning a new language versus seeking and gaining self-expansion by intimacy, closeness with someone else?
Any kind of self-expansion, when it's rapid and it's major, can be very important. But including someone else is a much bigger deal than learning a new language. But the other thing, at a certain point, the person remains part of who you are, even when things settle down a little bit. and you are expanded. And it is like addiction. And in fact, in a lot of brain scan studies we've done, fMRI studies, when you look at a person you've fallen in love with or that you're intensely in love with, an area of your brain, the dopamine reward system,
That's the same what that reacts to cocaine, right?
Like cocaine, yeah. And the reason is that it's not that we were designed to respond to cocaine, but cocaine happens to hit that area, so it becomes addictive. But that rapid expansion is kind of addictive. We want more of it. And there's evolutionary reasons for that with regard to relationships, in that when you fall in love with someone, you want to stay connected with them while you're raising the children. And so that addiction of sort to the person. And of course, people also, another major source of love is love towards a child.
And that really becomes part of you, right?
Yeah. There's been research done by others, not in our lab, showing brain scan studies, fMRI studies, that when you look at a newborn, you know, not brand newborn, because you're often a little depressed at that time if you're a woman, but there can be that same activation of the brain as when you're looking at a newly in love person. So, you know, and you want to certainly be addicted to taking care of that child.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much research around romantic love in this regard. It's not only in the very beginning that you can have that really strong dopamine. I mean, I've had Helen Fisher on the show before, and I didn't connect the dots until quite recently, but you were the collaborator with her on the study of people who had been married, was it on average 20 years, some of them 40 years.
Yeah.
And who still reported being very much in love, not just loving, but being in love and getting, I mean, the dopamine response was the same as with people who had just fallen madly in love, right? When they thought about the significant other.
And it is possible. We did a U.S. national survey where we found that among people who were married 10 years or longer, on the average, it was about 20 years, 40% claimed to be very intensely in love.
40% is a lot.
Of course, that means only 20% of those that got married.
because half of them have divorced already. Okay.
But still, that's more than we expected. And that's part of why we did the fMRI study that we did with Helen, because we wanted to see whether people are just claiming they're intensely in love. There really is something going on.
I mean, we had a whole discussion with her about, what to do. First of all, I mean, to say the problem is that this is amazing news for newlyweds or people who have just fallen in love. Oh, it doesn't have to be. I don't even know where the idea comes from, but it's a very common idea, both in pop culture and in psychology. The romantic aspect, the passion aspect subsides naturally over time. And there's even some psychologists kind of said that it would be almost pathological for it not to subside, right? Well, it seems that it doesn't have to subside, but this is not only good news for everyone, right? Because people easily get jealous. And quote unquote, realizing that, oh my God, 20% of the people who got married, they're madly in love. Well, I'm not madly in love. I think I thought I was doing great, but now the bar is higher.
Yeah.
First of all, do you encounter that kind of reaction a lot?
Well, I mean, in general, one of the ways that makes people feel good about themselves is to feel they're doing better than other couples. People leave.
Yeah, exactly.
They always argue. We don't argue, you know. But when people hear about our study showing that, you know, 40% claim to be very intensive, it's sometimes a little scary to them. But what we like about it is it may be a push to get up and do something. It is possible. Oh, and there are things you can do to keep it sparked up. One is our research focuses on doing exciting things with your partner. If you do new, novel, interesting, growthful things, it's sort of you're self-expanding with the partner. And so you have that experience of self-expansion. And since you're doing it with the partner, you associate it with the relationship. So it's a way to sort of reinvigorate that sense of rapid self-expansion. You know, shown it in lots of studies and other people have replicated it. If you regularly do new, interesting, exciting things with the partner, it really helps, keep the relationship sparked and alive. There's other things too. I mean, another body of research one we were involved in a little bit is having close couple friendships. If you have close friendship with another, if you and your partner have a close friendship with another couple, that deepens, it helps your relationship.
Interesting. Okay. Why do you think?
Well, one of the reasons is that you tend to see your partner being responsive, which is a really good thing. And they also are exposed to new things from you, as you interact with another couple. You know about what we call the fast friends procedure, the 36 questions, as it's called.
Yeah, so this might be what, for example, for listeners, they might have, without realizing, known you for, is the 36 questions that make you fall in love, was the famous article about this in, was it New York Times or where, and it became really viral.
We've done some studies showing that when you do that with another couple, each of the four of you answers each question, it really helps your own relationship. There was a whole bunch of research before we did that showing there was a correlation between couple friendship and the quality of your relationship. We didn't know which was causing which. By doing experiments where we had couple doing this versus a small talk task, we found that it not only, it deepened their friendship, but it also expanded their own sense of passionate love for their partner. That's one thing, is having close couple friendships. Another one is celebrating your partner's successes. That has a bigger effect on the good sides of your relationship than supporting them when things go badly. Although that's also very important.
Really? But it has a bigger effect. Interesting. Yeah.
I mean, one of my favorite examples, my wife and I, we collaborate on lots of stuff, but when we see a new paper come out related to relationships, we apply it to our relationship right away. It came out on this thing about celebrating your partner's successes. And my wife and I, her main work is something called the highly sensitive person. Which I collaborate with her on. And she had just recently submitted a major paper. I was a co-author on the highly sensitive person. She submitted a lot of studies, but this was to a very top journal. And I was home when the email came in saying the editors loved it, the reviewers loved it. Just minor changes that can be published. So I made a poster out of that email I got from the editor and put it on the front door for when she came. We had a great.
Okay. Can I return? I mean, it makes sense with the self-expansion model in the sense that if all we gain from each other is kind of support when things go bad, well, that feels nice, but that's comforting. And
yes,
it's not expanding in the same sense as the other one, celebrating your expansion.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this expansive journey together.
Yeah.
So that makes a lot of sense. And I wanted to actually, do I remember right? I think that I've seen a paper showing a test of this idea of doing novel things together, where there was two groups of couples. One was allocated to do something that they had rated as being quite novel, not necessarily that pleasant, but very novel. And then the other group was supposed to do tasks that were not necessarily very novel, but quite pleasant. And these are quite a strikingly different. I mean, neither one of them was very bad for the relationship, but the novel things, even if they were not so pleasant, were significantly better. Right. Do I remember this right? This right? Was it your paper or someone else's?
I think it was one of my papers, yeah. But it's like, novelty is really good, so long as it's not over the top. If it's more than you can handle, that's not good. It's got to be. Challenging activities are good so long as you can handle them, so long as they're right. In fact, the harder they are and the more, the better, up to the point where you can't handle.
How do you do novelty without, I mean, I'm sure that doing things like going to new places, taking on a dance class, if that's not something you do, taking a cooking class, all of these things, these kinds of things. I mean, it needs a little bit of creativity after a while, but this can be great. What about on a day-to-day? Are there any things like without doing this kind of grand, hey, let's do something we've never done together, let's enroll on a dance class. Are there things that you can recommend on a kind of more like micro novelties that are easier to just bring to day-to-day life? Or what would you say is the best protocol to make people introduce novelty
in a relationship?
I don't know. I mean, it's also sort of creative and exciting just to discuss with your partner. What can we do this week that we haven't done before?
So maybe one novel thing a week would be a good protocol.
Yeah. Even if it's, you know, it's like going to a restaurant that's a different kind of food than you're used to. And I've never been to a, you know, Ethiopian restaurant. Let's go to one or whatever it might be. For many people, going to concerts or plays, you know, they're not the same play or the same concert. Even watching movies, you know, if it's a really interesting, exciting movie that you've never seen before and you're watching it with your partner, that's that sense of connection to the partner is crucial for helping your relationship.
I really like the kind of this reminder of not only do stuff that is pleasant, but do stuff that is novel. I mean, it reminds me, it's a very different one, but there are, there's a lot of these studies on how when one group of people are asked to do something every day that they really like, eat an ice cream or whatever. So it's like a small nice thing. And another group is asked to do something nice for someone else every day. And it turns out that the second group tends to report much better, just subjective happiness. It's a better idea even for yourself. Now, it's a different context, different finding. I'm not drawing a strong analogy. It's just that it reminded me of, it's nice to see this kind of, well, I wouldn't have thought, but okay, so I need to kind of double check on what I do when I do something, when I enjoy myself. Okay, doing something nice for someone else. Great idea. What should I do to enjoy my relationship? Not just doing something pleasant, but something noble. Okay.
I think one of the things that's inspiring, we might do a study, I think, for couples, as a couple, to do something for the world, for others they haven't done before, I think could be really an exciting way to expand the self.
Yeah. Well, let me know if there's a study coming up.
Well, I think that's a good idea. We could take a look at some of the existing studies and see if we can apply them at the couple level. But I would think so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that could be very interesting. That'd be very interesting.
I mean, you sometimes see couples at like food banks that have volunteered together.
Yeah. Very exciting. Okay, let's return to that. But what about if there are issues, if you feel like there's, and I don't want to devalue the role of just having intimacy, having comfort, having a companion. But if you do have a situation where you've kind of fallen into a pattern of companionate love without romance, and you would want to rekindle the romance, perhaps created out of nothing if there never was any, is there anything else in that context? Would it be the same things that you just said, or is there something else?
No, all those things I just said, but I think for a relationship to manage overall, there's things they need to do. They need to be able to handle conflicts. Themselves is a huge issue.
No, I do think it's interesting you saying that, because I can easily see myself, but listening to this conversation and then immediately think, she never does this and she never does that.
Yeah. I mean, if you are anxious or depressed, it's really hard to have a good relationship with anyone. We often think it's the other person's fault. What you can do if you're anxious or depressed is to, you know, do something about it. If it's minor, you can learn to meditate, or if it's a little bigger, you could get therapy, or if it's very big, you might need to see a psychiatrist and get some sort of medication. But dealing with that is really important. And other things are hard to deal with too, like conflicts, you know, learning how to handle conflicts are really important. Being responsive to the other person is crucial for your communication. And if you're in a conflict, there's a lot of different things you can do. But one big one is to, from the recent research, is to try to take a perspective of some third party that cares about both of you, but it's neutral. And if you can take that perspective, both of you can especially, that can really help. I mean, those are some of the basics that you sort of need to be sure are reasonably in place, to then go on to spark it up. But even with all that going on, sparking it up can help some.
We've talked about romantic love a lot, but I wouldn't want to see your research just from the point of view of romantic relationship. You've done a lot of things in closeness, intimacy more generally. I think the funny thing is that you mentioned earlier the 36 questions. Now, these became incredibly viral, and I'll leave a link to them so anybody who wants to try them out can try. But the funny thing is that they weren't designed to create love at all, right? They were mostly used in the original research. They were used with same-sex heterosexual people to create a sense of closeness that might be conducive to friendship, perhaps, but certainly not romantic love, right?
That's right. I mean, it was designed really not for the practical world. It was designed for for research labs. So if we wanted to look at the effect of closeness on attitudes towards something or your well-being and, something that changes, if we just took close people versus non-close people, they have different histories, they selected each other, so we could bring them in the lab and randomly assign them to get closer or not, and then look at the effects. And it does, 45 minutes, people at the end of it feel almost as close to the person they did this with as to the closest person in their life. But it doesn't necessarily last, but it does create that. Now, of course, if this was someone that might otherwise be appropriate for, if you did it with a cross-gender person, if you're heterosexual, and it's reasonably appropriate for you to fall in love with, you might, if other things are in place, might, spark it and move it in that direction. But it wasn't designed for that. And the one place we find it increases passionate love is where two couples do it. But I mean, one of the original studies we did that's very important for your podcast is there was a lot of research showing that if you have a friend in another ethnic group or another group of any kind, you're more likely to feel positively about that group. But we didn't know what the direction of causality was. Was it that, being more positive makes you more likely to have a friend in that group? So we randomly assigned cross-ethnic cross-ethnic pairs of people who didn't know each other to get close to the other or not. And then we, in another context, we measured their attitudes towards the other group. And if you do the close procedure, it improves your attitudes towards the other group.
Yeah, it is fascinating and very important. Do I remember right that you run a study like that once with was it the whole cohort of a psychology course or a
big chunk, yeah.
And it had pretty lasting impacts, not just the next day, but much later, right?
Yeah. And of course, one of the more practical things we've developed since is called extended contact. If you're aware of someone in your group who has a friend in another group, that also makes you more positive. And in fact, we came up with this theory with Steve Wright, my collaborator, about 20 years ago. And we just did a meta-analysis, I think it was last year or a couple of years ago, of like 20, 30 studies, more than that, that have come out, not just ours, but lots of them showing this effect. And the idea is, and one of my favorites is, this was done with elementary school children in England, where they had them read, in one of the classes, they had them read stories of that included an English kid having a good friend with a South Asian kid. And then they looked at who they played with when they went out into recess. And they were more likely to play with, the other group than if they had read it. It wasn't like that. lots and lots of studies have shown this. And, if you could show people, like even in videos, of two people of different groups being close friends, that improves their relationship with the other group. And this effect is as strong, we found it was a surprise to us, but in the meta-analysis where we combined the results of all these studies, this result was as strong as what we found in direct friendships.
Wow.
And the reason for that, we think, we don't know for sure, but we think the reason for that is the direct friendships have some disadvantages. That is, you can come to think of your friend in the other group as not typical of the other group.
Oh, interesting.
Also, if you have a friend in another group, you can be stigmatized for it by members of your group. It's a little tricky, whereas extended contact isn't like that.
But what's really good news, I think, is that there is something that if people get over the certain kind of, whether it's stereotypes or fears or whatnot, that withholds this kind of contact with the other group, it seems to spring from somewhere pretty deep, a readiness, even a willingness to do it. It was a really interesting study I read about. This had to do with self-expansion and that being also a motive, not just for romantic love, but also friendships. The idea that good friends, they are a way for me to, for us to expand ourselves. And so the study was really clever. And what it did was, we often would think that, well, we want to make friends with people who are similar to us because, and yes, it is easier. But what in the study, the researchers, and tell me if this was yours, did, was to manipulate the idea of whether it's, they're going to be a friend or not. And if the subjects were told that this person is probably going to be your friend, you're probably going to befriend them, then suddenly actually being different increased the willingness. Like people wanted the very different ones to be interacting with them. Was this your study or?
I was involved in that. Yeah, I think Steve Wright was the main author, but I was definitely. And you didn't know that was the purpose of the study at all. And in fact, the only way you knew which group the other was in by their name, but we had it so that the names were clearly of a different group.
And so immediately if people feel like there's not going to be any of these hurdles, whatever the hurdles are that keep us from being friends, then it's actually a set for them to be different almost rather than a...
Well, we have another study we did that shows in another context, not about groups, but that if you are aware of, and then another person might, you know, become a friend, if they have different interests than you, you actually prefer them. So if you're interested in science and they're interested in music, that's a plus if you think it would work out. More expanding.
More expanding. Yeah, there we go. Another example of this deep readiness to reach out across the invisible boundaries between us, that I'm not sure what exactly the relationship is to your research, but I recently, I don't know if you've seen this, I recently saw this video, I think it was made in Germany and Poland, where there were people, mainly native people from these countries, and refugees, especially from Syria, who engaged in, I think it was a 2 or 3 minute exercise where they would have unbroken eye contact for 3 minutes without words, if I remember right. And the results were fascinating. And your name was mentioned as one of the kind of theoretical, in the theoretical backdrop when I read more about this. What exactly was your relationship with this?
In an earlier study we did before the 36 questions, it was actually designed to create romantic feelings between strangers that would be appropriate. We had, in addition to 36 questions, we had look in their eyes for 3 minutes.
Were you allowed to speak or was it silent?
It was silent, yeah. So I mentioned briefly, that was just a dissertation. We never published that. But I mentioned that study briefly and I mentioned the eye contact in a footnote in our 36 question study when we published it.
Okay.
And people just took that like crazy as being really important.
Okay. And so have you seen this video that I think about from Europe?
Yeah, I see some of it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really touching. I'll also link it to the show notes. And it wasn't a scientific experiment as much as a kind of form of social activism, but it's just so touching how 3 minutes and people are just so close, intimate.
I was so happy to see that video and I'm glad it went crazy because what it's doing is if you think of the extended contact effect, it's showing people close friendships between people of different groups.
Yes, on the video.
One of them is your own group. That should make you feel better about the other group.
Yeah, yeah. What does it tell you about, if we go on a more speculative path for a while, what does it tell you about humans? To see this readiness, the ease at which the boundaries between us can immediately kind of fall down and intimacy, closeness can just appear, it seems, almost anywhere.
Well, I think, you know, there's this desire to expand the self. And I think it has a history of not just applying to relationships, but applying to your community. And we haven't done research on that, but I think it's there. And we do know you include your ethnic group in the self to some extent, but I think we want to broaden that. And I think humanity benefits from feeling our connections, and all of us feeling our connections with all of humanity. And the larger the group, and in fact, even beyond that, there's work on including nature in the self, including God, if you believe in God. But I think broadening that is really beneficial for the human race.
Yeah, yeah. On the other hand, the world is far from being a perfect place where we are all expanding by embracing everyone to our social selves. What's the biggest enemy of what is holding us back from the potential?
There's two fundamental human motivations, we argue. One is expansion, the other is survival. And if our survival seems threatened by another group or by some circumstance, then it's harder to try to expand in that direction.
I think that's a beautiful place to end. So my final question to all guests is, how has your research shaped your outlook on humanity?
I don't know if the research does exactly, except this shows me there's that possibility. Certainly when I apply it to my own life, it reaches me out and expands me and makes me, you know, seek more and more to expand. In fact, I practice meditation and I feel huge expansions to the universe.
You mentioned meditation earlier as something that can be a good starting point to improve your mental health. I wholeheartedly agree. What would be your go-to material method for someone who has heard this before or just hears it and wants to give it a try and is not going to sign up for a 10-day silent retreat but wants to improve their anxieties? Where should they start?
Well, research shows that most of the widely used meditations have good effects. I think I read the research as showing that the biggest effect is from transcendental meditation. Now, I practice transcendental meditation, so I can't claim to be, objective on this. But looking at the research, and some of it's very explicit about this, they all have, not all, but most of the major ones have good effects. But transcendental meditation seems to be a little easier for people to do for a long time, and seems to have bigger effect.
Professor Arthur Aaron, thank you so much for your wonderful research and your time today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
So that was it for today. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to learn more, there's plenty of other episodes on love and bonding. Episode 3 is on the neuroscience of love with Ruth Feldman. Episode 7 is with one of the legends of the field, Robert Sternberg. And 11 is with other legend and Aaron's collaborator, Helen Fisher. And if you like this and want to show some support, you can subscribe to the show, share it with a friend. And if you're a long-term listener and want to join the wonderful ranks of people who support me financially, you can do so at patreon.com/onhumans. Anyway, thank you as always for listening. Until next time, take care.